right, folks, welcome to another episode of Mentioned in Dispatches. Jim, give us a good, solid, booming announcement of Mentioned in Dispatches.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Mentioned in Dispatches.
There we go. Good, booming, godlike. We need an octaver to run the voice through so we can sort of lower it a little bit of reverb action going.
Sure.
Something truly godly sounding. So, as you can guess, Jim is here. Cyrano is with us. And then, also, Doug is back. Panzer Day. Howdy, Doug.
Howdy, howdy.
Yeah. So, whenever we've got you guys, we always seem to talk Napoleonic stuff.
There's nothing wrong with that.
Yes. Well, but I actually had something I wanted to throw out at you guys, just, being, you know, the historians that you guys are. This goes back to an online argument I had with somebody, God, almost 20 years ago at this point. Back when Douglas MacGregor wrote the book Breaking the Phalanx, he talked of a new revolution in military affairs with the speed at which information could be shared, dramatically reshaping the battlefield and the way in which warfare was going to be fought. And I think he was probably half right in what we've seen over the intervening two decades, in that the speed at which information can be shared has certainly changed the nature of warfare, but not necessarily kinetic warfare. You know, the information space has certainly changed. But there was a significant argument being made, a counter argument being made, that we haven't had a real revolution in warfare since World War I. And the argument was this. Up until World War I, you had very limited use of non-line-of-sight artillery. It started being developed post-Civil War, post-American Civil War, but it still wasn't good until even beyond World War I. But it was World War I, essentially, that turned warfare from a two-dimensional exercise into a three-dimensional exercise, because that was the point at which submarines and aircraft became actual viable tools of war. And that the combination of the non-line of sight, the ability to affect things that were not line of sight, and the ability for warfare to be fought in three dimensions, both really coming to fruition right around World War I, were the last real revolution in military affairs. So with that as a table setter, Doug, what are your sort of instant reactions, and then let you ponder a little more while Jim gives some of his?
I think that argument overlooks a rather large dead horse on the table in terms of nuclear weapons. You know, I don't know how you could argue that nukes were not a revolution in warfare.
Are they not just a bigger boom?
Well, they are a bigger boom, but that ignores a lot of the other effects of having nukes, which led to deterrence, which led to warfare, which led to Cold Wars, right?
Yeah.
Where, you know, so maybe it doesn't dramatically change what a battalion or brigade commander is doing in an actual shooting war, but certainly at a strategic level, it changed things. And I think it also pretty dramatically changed things at an operational level, just because of the different size formations and how you would deploy them. You know, again, we've moved from mass armies back to much smaller, more highly trained, not conscription-based forces. And I think a lot of that was driven by two things: the speed of communications and the presence of nuclear weapons, because you no longer are going to have a war that lasts long enough for a conscript army to really be that useful, unless it's an extremely low intensity conflict, which is again a dramatic spinoff of the presence of nukes. You don't get the kinds of wars that we've had in the last, certainly the last 50 years, definitely the last 30 years. I mean, it's was what, this past week or the week before was the 30th anniversary of the first Gulf War?
Not quite yet. We're not quite to the 30th anniversary yet. It'll be 2021 because it was 91.
Okay. Yeah, so it must have been the
we hit a 25th anniversary not too long ago.
It was a couple years ago. That was it. It was the 25th. But so either way, I mean, the fact that that's 25 years ago is sort of mind-bending to me. But, you know, so I think you get dramatic changes there. I would also say that one of the things that it's often difficult to know that you're in the midst of revolutionary change when you're in the midst of it.
Yes, and that's a key thing.
And I would argue that we are in the midst of an even more dramatic change than we saw from nukes, something on the order of what we saw from the introduction of, you know, mechanized warfare in World War I with the advent of information technology-driven war. Whether you're talking about you know, remotely controlled autonomous vehicles, or you're talking about actual information warfare. You know, the stuff that's going on with information warfare, cyber warfare, which has, as we have just seen over the last couple of years, dramatically advanced past the sort of brute force cyber attacks that we saw against the Iranian nuclear centrifuges, for example.
Yeah.
You know, that those are actually very crude in comparison to the things like social media manipulation and, you know, the infrastructure attacks are one thing. Those have a very clear analog to shooting war.
Yeah.
But I would argue that the stuff that we're seeing in terms of public manipulation through social media, I mean, who's conducting that stuff? The GRU is conducting that stuff. Other militaries are conducting that stuff. And every military is investing very, very heavily in a cyber warfare capability. That is a dramatic, dramatic change in capabilities and in the nature of warfare.
Well, so I'm going to put the devil's advocate hat on here real quick and argue that while they are significant evolutions from where they started, are they legitimate revolutions in that the social media campaign type stuff like you're talking about is not markedly different in its original intent from World War I era propaganda. It is insanely more efficient.
From that perspective, then you could argue that aircraft in World War I are not significantly different from the intent of observation balloons in the Civil War.
Well, no, because observation balloons weren't armed and were tethered.
Okay, then so. You can't really argue that machine guns are significantly different from an organ gun that was used in the Italian wars in the 1490s.
Yeah, but again, I think you could make that case that there was a consistent evolution there, and that goes back to that whole World War I was the last real revolution argument in that's the one that made warfare 3D. I don't think we have any records of observation balloons shooting at each other. Yeah, there was an attempt at submarine warfare in the American Civil War also, but the point at which they became viable is kind of World War I is where, again, warfare went 3D. You mentioned nukes.
You just skipped over exactly what I started the whole argument with, which is it is very difficult to tell that you're in the midst of a revolution when you're in the midst of it.
Yep, absolutely.
Okay, and so to draw the conclusion that, well, a propaganda poster and mass manipulation of a populace via something like social media attacks.
Yeah.
are the same thing, I think falls very much into that. You know, you can make, yeah. There's literally nothing new under the sun.
Well, and that's where I think if you simply compare where it started to where we are today, they are completely different. But I think if you follow, you know, if you trace them along through Mata Hari, right, through, you know, dropping leaflets on the Iraqi population before we start bombing them in 91.
I would argue, number one, that those are materially different.
Yeah.
Okay. But also, what I'm saying is that, I mean, the Krupp guns that were used at Sedan in 1870 were an evolution of Napoleonic howitzers.
Yeah.
Which were an evolution of other guns from earlier times, and the field pieces of World War One, which quote unquote, you know, allowed for this indirect fire, they were just scaled up. All right, so there's nothing magic happened at World War One. You had a culmination of a lot of evolutionary things,
yeah,
that produced a revolutionary result.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I'm saying the same thing is happening right now. There are a lot of evolutions of things that if a large scale war happens, we're going to obviously see it. But I think we're seeing it day by day, and we're just not recognizing it, that there is actually a very revolutionary set of things happening right now, that are very different in their outcomes. There was never, and, you know, without getting into a lot of politics here and prompting a lot of
hate mail,
stuff that I really don't want to get into, but, it, you know, if you accept that, here, I'll use a different one that's less likely to get us as much hate mail. If you accept that Russian manipulation of social media resulted in the Brexit vote in the UK, or contributed significantly to it, there is no amount of World War One posters or dropping leaflets over anybody at any time that produced something of that magnitude.
Yeah, yeah. Now,
right?
Yeah.
If you combine that with other forms of cyber warfare,
oh, yeah,
things up to and including things like GPS jamming.
Yeah, it's a mess. We've
and it's revolutionary, in my opinion. I mean, you could potentially effectively disarm a country.
Yeah. We've left Jim sitting here for like 10 minutes, probably got a laundry list of things he's ready to go at us with at this point, but let's let Jim react to any and all of that.
Yeah, I mean, it's strange you bring this up because I have been making my way back through Keegan's History of Warfare, which, as Professor Keegan always did, tried to take a long view in a very high level view of history rather than getting lost in minutiae. Although truthfully, some of the things he excelled at were minutiae, you know, looking at ancient weapons, and he tells the story in there of going to an ancient weapons collection and asking somebody in the museum, so what exactly would this have done to bone? And the curator of the museum went, I don't know, that's a horrible question to ask. And he said, well, that's what it's for.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, it's, what do you mean? He said it made it feel like he was asking a rude question. But Keegan, in many ways, was the first guy to do that. But to the topic at hand, I'm going to go along with Doug on the idea that what we saw in World War One was indeed a revolution because it knit together a number of streams. And I'll speak only briefly of two. The first was, it will be remembered, the first mass conscription occurs during the Napoleonic Wars. It's one of the reasons the Napoleonic armies are so effective. They, in Gary Oldman's words, they brought everyone.
Yep.
You know, and none of the other armies of Europe were able to compete with that when imbued with a certain amount of elan, of revolutionary fervor. And that whole and by the time you get through that period, everybody is conscripting. They see the necessity of it. You then have mechanization. You have you have improvements in artillery. And as Keegan points out again, and as Max Hastings points out in his First World War, everybody acts, and we have this gross misunderstanding of the First World War, that nobody knew what was going to happen. That isn't true. I won't speak for dingbats like the Kaiser, or for the government in England, or John French, or, you know, all the different commanders at the very highest levels. But there are military theorists who are looking at all these component pieces, much like in Real Genius, where Laszlo asks, what's it for? And he says, well, it's a one-use weapon. And he says, yeah, I get all that. What's it for? And these theorists look at all these, you know, mass conscription, mass industrialization, much higher rates of fire in the different guns, much more explosive power in the artillery, and said, you do realize that we're going to slaughter each other. And nobody accepts this at the highest levels. But military theorists left and right are saying, this is going to be horrible. And as the war goes on, from August of 14 on, we suddenly go, and so not only does that happen, but suddenly we have a whole different way that war affects us, where now everybody's in. And I know people talk about the 30 Years' War, which indeed was probably the worst war before this one, in terms of its effect on the civilian population. And people talk about Russia, and they talk about Moscow and all this other stuff, and the Napoleonic Wars. Nothing's like the First World War, in terms of who it kills, how it destroys entire, almost civilizations in its destructive force. So I'll absolutely give the idea of revolution to the First World War. But I also think, and here's my problem. I'm going to call myself and I do not want to touch the politics of this, but I am a deep skeptic on the whole social media thing, in terms of its capacity to affect elections. Now, that may be because I still have basic faith in human nature, which may be a fault. It has come to me on numerous occasions that it's like, are you telling me that the whole of the infiltration was Facebook posts and people being persuaded of things on Facebook? Okay, so I'm confronted with one of two realities. Either that's true and we've got to deal with it, but that requires me to believe that we are profoundly stupid as a species. Or B, it was there and it washed off like water off a duck's back. I don't know what the truth is, and we won't know until history is allowed to judge, I guess.
Doug and I are both thinking you need to spend more time on a computer telephone help desk before you put too much faith in humanity there.
You may be right, but I'll finish up just by saying the one thing I don't know, because I'm not an expert and I don't see it, is I do wonder. I know for a fact, because my brother does some of it, and I know some individuals who are engaged in it professionally, but the cut and thrust of cyber warfare is out there. You know, there are men and women on, you know, what was it that Colonel Jessup said, out on that wall. And they're doing it tonight, right as we're talking. They're fighting an incursion here and an incursion there. And to Doug's point, 100%, it's not, you know, this isn't Operation Barbarossa. It's nothing like that. It's something far more subtle. Oh, and on the topic of nuclear weapons, yeah, that's hard to stress out in terms of military tactics and strategy and operations. But I'll guarantee you this much. What's going on in the Punjab between India and Pakistan is a totally different scenario if those two sets of jokers didn't have nukes.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Because I think what you'd have is much more like what we saw in the horrific bloodbath of the Iran-Iraq war. You know, there were two groups with masses of troops, masses of tanks, masses of committed individuals, and lunatic commanders on both sides that were willing to engage, you know, turn their countries into charnel houses.
Yeah.
And I don't think for a minute that India and Pakistan hate each other any less than that. Matter of fact, I think ad arguendo, they hate each other more. And I think that they would be absolutely creating a bloodbath were it not for the fact that A, they have nukes and they understand those consequences, but B, the rest of the world knows they have nukes and will jump into the fray to say, gentlemen, ladies, let's be rational about this before this gets out. And despite all that, there's a reason that GMT's next warp, India-Pakistan, is becoming a good seller right now. People are exploring the question.
Yeah. Well, I think going back to Doug's argument about nuclear weapons being a revolutionary tool, and just to be clear, part of me making the counter-argument was not necessarily that I'm buying it whole cloth. It's trying to generate some discussion here. Sure. But I think one of the key things that gets glossed over a little bit, but, you know, Doug, whether you meant to articulate this or not, I didn't hear you specifically call it out, is nuclear weapons are one of the few weapons in which the effects extend far beyond the actual battlefield. Again, it's a really big boom, but it's a really big boom with a whole lot of fallout that doesn't stay in place. You know, I was living in Germany when Chernobyl blew up. You know, there's a reason all of us, you know, folks wandering around West Germany were joking about the red gummy bears being the Chernobyl bears. You know, again, one of the reasons why people might care if India and Pakistan goes nuclear is, you know, that radioactive cloud's not going to just sit down in place. And it's going to start affecting lots of other people.
Well, and interesting. I agree that has a lot to do with it. I'd also say that it's interesting that you bring up Chernobyl, because there's more and more reports coming out that the exclusion zone around Chernobyl is not nearly as badly irradiated or as dangerous as everybody thought it would be. And I think in many cases the non-specialist perception of the non-battlefield effects of nuclear weapons, particularly the radiation and fallout effect, is overestimated. I've had recent conversations with some of my own business colleagues that, you know, believe that that's it, right? You know, you explode a nuclear bomb and the radiation never goes away, and you know, anybody that gets within miles of an explosion site for the next 10,000 years immediately dies of radiation poisoning. That's not really the impact. Most of those weapons are actually designed to produce a lot of blast and heat, but not nearly as much radiation as people tend to think.
Yeah, because otherwise you're occupying radioactive ground after the fact.
Right, yeah, that's exactly right, right? Now, the problem is that if you're really good at making really big booms with a lot of heat and blast, you burn a lot of stuff. And what you do is you throw a lot of soot into the atmosphere. So, you know, the most recent estimate that I saw just the other day, if India, Pakistan were to go nuclear, is that you're looking at a famine that kills maybe as many as 2 billion people. That's pretty revolutionary in my book. You know, I think Jim's absolutely right. I think there is a recognition of, boy, if we go here and an Iran-Iraq level bloodbath, particularly on one side or the other, you know, somebody loses really badly, could prompt a nuclear exchange, and that's keeping commanders all the way up the chain from committing to that style of warfare.
Yeah. Yeah. So here's how we draw this back to the armchair dragoons. How do we turn this into something we can account for in a war game?
Ooh.
Jim?
Well, I mean, Dunnigan wrote a book about it, right? It was called The Bomb in the Computer, I think. You know, Jim Dunnigan was, I don't know if you guys have seen what has happened to the war game marketplace on Facebook.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You know, this is some scuzzy behavior on Facebook's part. They can die in a fire and I'll take it. but it was that prompted me to look up a quote. And I put it out on my Twitter feed. A conflict simulation is another word, is another name for war game, one that leaves out the two unsavory terms war and game. That's Jim Dunnigan, and he has been deliberating in part for his work for the Rand Corporation, if I remember correctly, and for a number, and of course the armchair dragoons of history. He has been trying to simulate the effects of nuclear exchanges, both large and great. Really, is, you know, it's a product of the Cold War. We have been at that for a very, very long time. I think one of the restraints that has always been there, and it goes particularly to, I think it is in one of Patty Griffith's books, where he shows an amazing terrain setup at 6mm somewhere in Germany. Grant, you probably, or your dad probably tripped over it at some point in your careers, the terrain right in full the gap.
Yeah.
Rendered in 6mm, except it's in a dining hall. I mean, it's huge, and it's the entire floor. But one of the things that the rules makers for this did is they worked in the possibility of a nuclear exchange at the tactical level. And there was a tremendous amount of ethical and moral debate. Should we even simulate that? You know, should that be part of our calculus? Should that be part of what we're training for? And this is at the height of the Cold War. Now, you know, we went through the nonsense of the end of history. That didn't turn out well. you know, so we're back. We're very much back there with Russia rearming, with us never having really disarmed. And we're, again, I think, going to be confronted with the question of, we have always been, we have always been limited in conflict simulation by those who would say, you can't think about that.
But somebody needs to.
Well, so I much like I said about computers, I sincerely hope somebody is.
They definitely are. You know, I can remember having talks with my dad back in the late 70s, early 80s, when he worked for the Air Force and was running simulators at the Air Force Avionics Lab, that they were definitely simulating nuclear combat effects. And there are games that make a stab at it today. In fact, there was a post just the other day on the Matrix boards about Flashpoint Campaigns, a game near and dear to all of our hearts. Shout out to our friends at
On Target Simulations.
But the question was, you know, hey, the game, you guys have inserted some nukes in here, but you haven't really done it, you know, at the level that this particular poster believed needed to be in there. So I think we see some of it. I think that it's become, for exactly the reasons that you just mentioned, Jim, I think that it's become less popular to try and simulate in off-the-shelf games in the last 20 years because everybody wanted to believe that, oh, we don't ever have to worry about that again. You know, those days have largely gone, and so you don't see as much of that in games today. You don't see the corollary of biological and chemical, which I think equally need to be considered, particularly biological warfare effects being simulated in some way. The cyber warfare piece, which because of what I do, I actually have quite a bit of firsthand experience at this point.
Yes, you do.
Yeah, it's kind of my day every day. I have a hard time. I think about that from a game perspective, and I have to admit that I kind of back away from it and tend to think, I'm not sure that a typical conflict simulation can really capture that as well as it ought to. And certainly a lot of the ancillary, more civilian-directed kinds of stuff is probably not going to show up. You're going to get stuff that reflects attacks on command and control centers, and, you know, there'll be some friction kind of effect imposed on units because of communication jamming and stuff like that. You won't see some of the other stuff necessarily in a war game, but you know, part of it, I think, is I spend so much time dealing with it every day and considering it every day and thinking about it every day that when it comes time to think about it from the perspective of my hobby, I'd rather think about phalanxes and legions and muskets and cannons.
A couple of things. You know, Jim, you talk about Dunnigan's famous quote of, let me call it a conflict simulation because it avoids the two words of war and game. Of course, the challenge there is that there are conflicts that are not wars, and there are simulations that are not games. And so, you know, at that point, you've just significantly broadened the horizon of what you're talking about, whether you mean to or not. And now all of a sudden, there's a lot more possibly in play than people really intended when you start talking about conflict simulations instead of war games. Despite the fact that it may be a more or a less ethically challenging title to what we do.
I want to throw a stick here. I rarely do this kind of thing because, frankly, I do enough politics in my day job, much like Doug doesn't in any way, shape, or form want to discuss modern, you know, in military engagements. I certainly hate politics for reasons I think you're all pretty well familiar with. But I'm disgusted by the idea that people would be offended by simply the term war games without any sort of understanding what that means.
Yeah.
You know, and for those who don't know, and I don't want to talk around this just for those who might not know, Pastor Joel Toppin, who is a really good guy, the guy starts a Facebook page to help people sell war games. I've bought games from there. And it's a, you know, as he himself pointed out in a message just today as we're recording this, he has, you know, it's just a labor of love. He doesn't make a nickel from the damn thing. And it's on Facebook, and it's a place where this little niche of 8,000 guys, because we're predominantly guys, not all, but predominantly, can get together and sell games between ourselves. That's all. Get rid of our old ones and maybe buy a new one. It would seem that somebody or somebodies are griefing him to Facebook saying, oh, this is a bad site. It's doing something that's that traduces the Facebook rules of conduct or whatever have you, and people have been shut out of the site. He's had to change the name. He's had to take it secret instead of private. I am more than happy to call them war games. I don't worry about that for a minute. But it's the world in which we live that without any examination, without any reflection, the Great Leap Forward, what were they called, the struggle sessions of the Chinese Cultural Revolution, demand that you abjure calling it a war game for entry into civil society, and that's disgusting.
Going back to part of what Doug was discussing how do we deal with this in the game sense? You know, part of the challenge in all of this is this goes back to some of the questions that I ask when you start talking about putting civilians in war games, or how do we do certain things with irregular warfare, or people that want a logistics model in a war game. Well, okay, fine. When I'm playing lock and load tactical, the logistics are pretty irrelevant, right? I mean, you're talking about a 2-hour gunfight. Somebody might run out of ammo, probably not, but nobody's running out of food and water. It's not siege warfare in the 1600s,
right,
or something.
Right.
And so when you start talking about how are these game effects going to take place, nuclear weapons don't belong anywhere below a theater level. Because if you drop a nuclear weapon on a lock and load tactical map, you just light the board on fire and it's done.
Right. I mean, it's a matter of scale.
It's a matter of scale. And assuming you drop one four boards over and all that happens is some radioactive fallout, it's not going to affect those dudes for another 6 years. And in the meantime, the fact that there's anti-war protests going on back home doesn't help that guy in the 2 hours that he's in the middle of that firefight. Right. So at what scale do you put these things in place? But moreover, what's the effect that it's going to have in the game? And I don't want to just make this about nuclear weapons, because this is also true about, you know, some of the propaganda effects. Okay, great. Mata Hari's on the radio in World War II. What's the game effect of Mata Hari telling folks, you know, pack up and go home, GI? I keep saying Mata Hari. That's totally wrong. Tokyo Rose. I don't know why I'm throwing Mata Hari out there.
I thought maybe she got resurrected.
Yeah, maybe. The Tokyo Rose. Who was the German one?
Axis Annie.
Axis Annie. Mm-hmm. Thank you. You know, the propaganda
brush. Sally, I'm sorry.
Baghdad Bob.
Yeah, well,
Baghdad Bob, yeah.
But Baghdad Bob was, he wasn't trying to convince people to go home. He was trying to, you know, just play up the press. He wasn't talking directly to the soldiers.
To convince the Iraqis not to go home.
Yeah, well, there was that. But the, you know, when you start talking about a cyber war hit on somebody, at what scale does the game need to exist before a cyber attack would actually have a discernible game effect? Assuming the game is not about cyber warfare, right? Let's take that off the table.
I think that's one of the places, and that's a really interesting question, because you're right. I completely agree with you that you know, nuclear weapons are a theater level kind of thing, and you know, certainly when you're talking about cyber warfare from the perspective of manipulating populations and things like that, in a tactical or grand tactical scale war game or even an operational game, that kind of stuff doesn't matter. However, the increasing importance of cybernetic systems. Nobody ever uses that word cybernetic anymore, by the way, and it really still very much applies. But when you start talking about there are literally people in the Army who are tactical networking specialists. That's an MOS today.
Oh, I know, because I know a bunch of the civilians that were the precursors to that MOS when they realized, hey, we should probably put these guys in uniform.
Right.
And okay, I worked with a bunch of them.
That's happening. You know, it's like the guys on the Eastern Front in World War II stringing telephone wire between positions in Stalingrad.
Yeah.
Okay. They're the proliferation.
There you go.
Yeah, it's 11 o'clock and my ability to talk is going.
I'm blaming alcohol.
Well, I wish, but the proliferation of cybernetic systems down to the individual soldier level and the plans for adding more of that stuff, whether you're talking about, our units are today making use of applications that run on their iPhones. There's a tool for snipers. There's all kinds of tools for providing tactical level leadership with updated maps, enemy positions, intelligence threat estimates, communication tools, etc., that are literally going to the individual soldier. On top of that, now we're going to have robots. It's really only a matter of a few months to a couple of years before we are going to see tactical employment of robots, first in primarily logistics roles, but eventually in actual combat roles. The protest against and the concerns people have about autonomous weapons being able to kill is that's a very legitimate debate, and I have long thought right from the outset that we started hearing about that debate that just like nukes, if you can do it, somebody's going to do it.
Yeah.
You're going to have autonomous weapons that have the ability to kill without human approval. It's just going to happen, just the same way we've got all kinds of landmines and chemical weapons and everything else. Somebody's going to build it. Might not be us, but somebody will. So now you have this battlefield that has all of this stuff out there. And, okay, so it's evolutionary. It's, you know, a force multiplier, etc. But as soon as you've got all that stuff, as soon as you've got battlefield networks, as soon as you need those communication links, data links to work between all of these weapon systems and computers that are embedded down to even the smallest weapon systems, there's, you know, some fat spare bedroom dweller like me that is going to figure out some way to sabotage those things.
Well, and that's assuming plenty of other things don't get in the way first. The idea of autonomy or autonomous decision making in weapon systems was a problem going back over 30 years at this point, going back to the USS Vincennes shoot down of the Iranian airliner over the Gulf in 87, I think it was. When the Vincennes shot down the airliner because.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, the system miscategorized it as a hostile aircraft taking off from a mixed use airfield while the Vincennes was in or very close to Iraqi national waters where they weren't supposed to be, engaged in a running gun battle with a bunch of Iranian gunboats. You get an aircraft taking off from an airfield known to have F-14s take off from it. And the Vincennes automatically tagged it as hostile, and nobody ever overrode it. And there's some significant evidence that the issue there was the crew was insufficiently trained to override the autonomous weapon systems that made the decision to shoot. We've had this problem for 30 years, and as a guy whose military career was completely within that 30-year window, I've never seen us make any significant strides in improving the training of how to override those autonomous systems or how to put a human eye on them such that we can say, hold on, you know, that the defense is no longer, I was just following orders. The defense is now, well, the machine told me to do it. That's not any better. we haven't really improved there. But now if the machine told me to do it because somebody told the machine to tell me to do it, that doesn't make me any more hopeful. These sorts of issues have been around for quite some time, and I'm not sure we've made any progress on tackling them as we've made enormous exponential strides in the ability to create more of them through our rapid improvements in technology and somebody going, hey, you know what would be a good idea? How about if we build this? How about we hit the pause button long enough to make sure that our ability to employ it catches up with our ability to build it?
But isn't that, you're going to love this, man, because I'm going to bring it full circle for you. Isn't that exactly where we started? Isn't that where we said, hey, you know, World War One, revolutionary, all this stuff happened because all these new technologies that were evolutions of stuff combined to create a battlefield environment and an impact of the war that was like nobody had ever seen before. Isn't that the same thing that we're saying now, that we've got, you know, all these systems, we have all this stuff that's been developed over all this time, and we're going to unleash it, right? You know, let's not forget that there are places, particularly around Verdun, that now over 100 years, people still can't live there.
Yeah.
Right. Well, look, I mean, there's so much just I will not go too far down this particular cul-de-sac, but when Counterfact magazine announced Ty Bombadil's game War Within the Megacity, I bought it instantly. And the reason I haven't it sits under a pile of things on my table downstairs, but the reason that I bought it immediately is it has a sweat factor. And for those who don't live in my world, which is municipal governance, sweat is sewer water, electricity, and trash removal. This is something that we do every day, that every single flipping human being with the technology sufficient to listen to this podcast takes utterly for granted.
Yep.
And all the stuff Doug is talking about, you can say what you want, that it's going to mess with tanks or it's going to mess with communications between troops. There's a level at which the people I work with say, screw that, it's going to mess with sweat.
Yeah.
Look at what is going on as we're talking down in Venezuela. You know, they have, you know, obviously the Maduro government insists this is an attack. I don't know if it is or it isn't, but that some of the largest cities on the planet are in the dark. And I'll let you in on a little secret. Very few of the sewers in the United States of America are younger than 50 years. Our water systems are increasingly controlled by computers. Our electricity systems are entirely controlled by computers. And now increasingly our trash removal is going to be controlled by computers.
You don't have to tell me about how old the water system is. The road in front of my house is a testament to that, with all of its new asphalt scarring thanks to a couple of years of emergency repairs, which always seem to happen at 2 a.m.
Now we're dealing with a situation nothing like Flint, nothing so dramatic, but in the city of Milwaukee, we're dealing with a situation where homes for decades were built with lead laterals. Well, everybody says, well, wait a minute, what were they before that? They were wooden.
Yeah.
You know, and so everybody thought at the time, hey, what a wonderful improvement. It's so much better than wood, it's lead. And so we installed lead. Well, now we got to get rid of that. But my point behind all this is there will be an aspect of warfare, and this is modeled in Ty Bomba's game, where especially as we start to see, and we will see this, but, you know, this is in our lifetimes, we will see the coming of the megacity. We are going to see warfare evolve far past anything we think of as war and into these places where you shut down the water supply in a city of, well, what's the population in New York City? Shut down their water supply and watch what happens.
We already know what happens because the Russians did it in Grozny in 93.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And that level of warfare is going to, I believe, and this maybe goes to Doug's point, you want your revolution? Behold. There won't be a shot fired, and you could have an entire city capitulate.
Right. And that attack can be perpetrated by a handful of state actors, or it may be perpetrated by a handful of non-state actors.
Yeah, and then you don't know who to shoot back at.
Exactly.
Yeah, I will tell you, Jim, your issue of the megacity piece, I sat in TRADOC headquarters in 2013 and sat through a combination briefing slash pitch meeting, quite frankly, for, hey, we've got some ideas where we're looking to reach out to the civilian gaming community to bring in some ideas for how do we war game, events in megacities. And they weren't looking for people to create scenarios. They had folks that could envision all sorts of scenarios under the sun. What they needed were the actual tools, the mechanisms through which to do those things and keep a record of them and provide some sort of adjudication, some sort of wide participation. We put a couple of ideas on the table, ended up that they had a bunch of great ideas and a bunch of things they wanted to do, and then they got a drop in the bucket worth of budget to work with. And ultimately, what that office produced was the militarized version of World of Tanks. I don't know if you've seen that pop up in one of Michael Peck's articles somewhere along the way. They pulled in, over the course of 2 weeks, about seven different contractors that I know of, just the people that I spoke with back then. And what they ended up with was a militarized version of World of Tanks in order to try and craft some better scenarios for how to deal with megacities. I have no idea how they came to that conclusion. But the idea, the military is absolutely considering this, and quite frankly, they're terrified of it because it's not something that they train for. It's not something they like having to deal with. Doug, it goes back to your point earlier that why are we thinking about these things? This sort of gives people the willies. Jim, you brought it up also. It shouldn't, but it does. people need to think about these things, because whether we want them to or not, they're going to happen. At some point, somebody's going to have a shootout in Lagos, Nigeria. You got 20 million people crammed into, you know, 1,000 square acres, maybe, and it's going to get ugly. And somebody's got to think about how do you deal with that, so we're not figuring out as we go.
Well, I think it's even going to get to the point. People who are thinking about this stuff are sophisticated enough to do things like, okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to use modern cyber warfare tools to produce a crisis in Lagos in order to prompt a reaction from other states to get them to commit resources so that they don't have resources to do something else, so that we can do what we're trying to do over here. Because they're all going to be watching this thing over here, because we got 20 million people without water and food.
Yes.
Right? So yeah. That kind of thing is going to happen, and no one will have deployed troops in order to do it. And that's kind of the place I get to with some of why I end up going back to the 18th century for my gaming, because I think that on the one hand, people that are thinking about this stuff, and I look at the games that are supposed to represent near future warfare or medium future warfare, and everybody's just doing straight line extrapolations. They're not really thinking about, you know, it has frustrated the hell out of me for 40 years, literally since Steve Jackson's battle suit.
Yes.
That more games haven't included an operator with multiple remotely piloted vehicles as his primary weapon system.
Yeah.
At a tactical level. Nobody's really done that since Battlesuit. And you could argue that Battlesuit didn't do it particularly well, but at least the idea was out there. And that's what it's actually going to look like. But, you know, we don't want to talk about that. We don't represent that. But that's really where it's going. So on the one hand, I look at it and look at what people are doing, and I'm going, wow, there's a real lack of imagination here. The other part of it is it's just a little too real and a little too close to home for me.
Yeah.
You know, and I can go back to, you know, Fontenoy in 1742 and, you know, the British and French guards were, you know, gentlemanly and inviting each other to fire their first volley. And it was a very different kind of war where things were a lot more up front.
Yeah. Yeah. And on that cheerful note, we may need to call it a night here, guys.
But I mean, let's just to put a button on it. I just happened to click past a news story. Venezuelans swarm sewage drains.
There you go.
In desperate search of water. Mm-hmm. I respect what Ty Bomba did in this game. I'm looking forward to trying it. But I will not say I'm looking forward to it from a, boy, this is going to be fun. Mm-hmm. Because yeah. There's nothing fun about that. Mm-hmm. That is real human suffering. And this is where our hobby, which we love, and which we, you know, we pursue all the time, takes an important step towards pivoting towards, wait a minute, this is a real live problem affecting the lives of real human beings who are suffering.
And you don't even need a war to create that. Grab a copy of Aftershock.
I'll question the use of the term war. Mm-hmm. I think sooner or later we're going to have to redefine what war is.
That's exactly my point.
Well, but Jim, you don't even need people to create that. What happened in Puerto Rico?
Right.
What happened in Haiti after the earthquake? Go grab a copy of Aftershock from Pax Sims, from Rex Briner, sure. And you deal with all that sweat stuff plus all the medical stuff layered on top of it. And then
that's right.
And then a heap and helping of interagency coordination on top of that.
And to your exact point, Brant, I strongly – that's a great example that folks – if you haven't had a chance, there is another game out there that goes by that name. But there's a game out there from PacSims called Aftershock. There are people who do what I do for a living, government, that use this as a teaching and a training tool.
Yeah.
You know, that look at this and say, when we're dealing with these real-life situations, we have to prepare somehow. So it's a funny line because Doug's absolutely right. We love to sit back like Baron Munchausen and imagine ourselves heroically leading the cuirassiers against the lines of the British or the British squares. But there is a use that is being made of these very same simulations that's very real, very difficult, very painful.
Yep. All right, guys. Look, we can go for another 2 hours on this, but my laptop won't hold an audio file that big. So, this has definitely been a lot of fun. We are only just now cranking up season 2 of Mentioned in Dispatches. So certainly look for more, and we will look if we revisit this discussion later. Somebody reach out to Ty, see if we can get him on the podcast. We ought to grab Rex.
Well, I was going to say grab Rex too. Ty and Rex are the two guys to ask about this.
Yeah, well, I know how to find Rex. Ty is a little more elusive. The only place I see him is on social media. Rex, I could text now if I wanted to wake him up. he's got to teach tomorrow. I don't want to do that to him. He's Canadian, so he'd be too polite to chew me out for it, but I still don't want to do that to him. So, this is definitely a discussion that I think will continue further down the season. So from the revolutionary podcast that is Mentioned in Dispatches, Doug, thank you. Jim, thank you. Appreciate y'all joining us, and let's do it again.